Welcome to the Future of Science podcast, this time with Juan Benet. Juan started multiple highly influential projects in the crypto world, like IPFS and Filecoin. He started his company, Protocol Labs, to build out further technologies to aid the preservation, spread, and usage of information. In this podcast, we talked about the grand ideas behind the technologies Juan and his network have been building over the past decade. We covered questions like, how do you store information over long periods of time, like really long, as in tens of thousands of years or even millions of years? How much information do we need and in which format in order to be able to jumpstart civilization after a potential collapse? And how do we transfer information in a multiplanetary society? Lastly, we learn how many hours of sleep Juan needs, and importantly, he told us, without missing a beat, what his spirit animal is. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you do, please don't forget to subscribe and review this podcast.
One of the things that I'd love to talk to you about is one of the most fundamental prerequisites for science, which is that we need to be able to record and preserve knowledge for the future and to make it as broadly accessible as possible. And that sounds like an easy task, but it is really not. So there is a lot of complexity to that, a lot of layers, so both on the technological side and on the human side. And I'd just love to jam with you about that.
Yeah. So I think that this problem kind of breaks down into different types of threat models. And you can think of it about, when you think about preserving knowledge, you have to think about preserving it for whom and for how long.
Yep.
The answers look very different when you're preserving something for, say, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, or even, say, millions of years. Like, storage media itself may not last that long, right? Like, if you want something to last a very long time, you might need to etch it in diamond and launch it into space or something to make sure that it doesn't get pulled into the core of the earth and melted. So definitely when you're thinking about the scale of preservation, you have to think about different strategies. I used to be really worried about making sure that humanity's information would be pretty well preserved for say millions of years and so on. Mm-hmm. But then I realized when you look at the time scale, it's only taken us about 10,000 years to generate everything we've generated so far.
Yeah.
So it's actually much more important to preserve the species. And if you can preserve the species, then you can regenerate 10,000 years worth of knowledge fairly quickly. Whereas the species takes about 50 million to a billion years, depending on how far you blast the species back. So I think the good news there is that our job in terms of preserving information gets a lot easier. You no longer have to worry about millions of years. You may only have to worry about hundreds to tens of thousands of years. And that problem is way, 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 way easier. You can think of storage media that's simpler to think about and so on. There's a couple use cases that I really care about. One is where in the shorter term, in the next few decades, there's a lot of information around the internet. So think of no kind of cataclysmic scenarios, just think about the day-to-day operation of how we go about our day-to-day work. Tons of information gets lost accidentally. So the web is highly dynamic. Lots of links are interconnected and they break often. And so people might move some web page from one location to another. People might move some data set. This is referred to as link rot. And so the web has this big problem around that. And I think that's very tractable and solvable in the shorter term. I think there's another use case that I think is really important as well, which is we are within our capabilities able to break civilization and get ourselves back for a couple thousand years. And I think there it would be really, really useful to be able to preserve some kind of arc of knowledge that you can reboot civilization with and so on, to not lose a lot of time. And so I think in that case, the storage media gets, what you really need is to compile what we think is the most important knowledge and replicate it around the planet and be able to place it in locations that are readily accessible, that are not going to get affected geologically in this short time span. So, away from volcanoes and away from high earthquake regions and so on. And then you have to think about the storage media such that you can bootstrap the learning process. This is in many sci-fi books, this is described as this bootstrapping process where you might have initially some amount of information recorded in stone that lets you get enough information to like build a device that lets you access like the higher density material, and then you keep bootstrapping all the way until you have like a full record of everything, like again, Etch and Diamond or DNA or something like that. DNA is like surprisingly stable storage, which is really cool. Surprisingly dense and stable, which is pretty cool. But anyway, so like most of the work that I've been doing is around this kind of link rot problem, and only a little bit on that second case. On the link rot problem, I think the biggest thing here is to make sure that we can interconnect and link information on the web with persistence, so that when you create some information and you add it to the network, you're able to have some identifier that kind of freezes that information with a snapshot. Like you might have to update it later, but you should be able to preserve every single version and be able to access every single version.
Exactly.
And ideally, you should have a structure where you don't, you as an individual or as an organization, you don't have to keep preserving the information. You should be able to just kind of add it to this large compendium of like the public record and just walk away and trust that it's going to be kept around.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually a really fundamental challenge for science. So there have been a couple of papers that looked at these problems of link rot and content drift in the scientific literature. And the problem is actually much, much more pervasive than most people think or are aware of, right? So there was a paper, for example, by Jones et al. In 2016 in PLOS ONE that was entitled Scholarly Content Drift. And then it says three out of four. It does, right? Yeah. That's scientists, right? It's selling their work. And then it says 3 out of 4 URI references are affected by changed content. And if you just look at the graphs that they put in there, so for example, the Elsevier corpus of published articles. So a lot of them, of course, they have references to web addresses, and then they just tracked how many of them have been affected by link rot or by content drift, and then they quantify like how much content drift. And it's really shocking. So even things that were published just 4 years ago, there's like 20% of it is already link rot affected.
Wow.
Another 20% is already affected by very substantial content drift. And if you scroll back to anything that was published by Elsevier or other journals before 2000, it's almost 100% of the references that are affected by link rot and content drift.
That's incredible.
Wow. It's shocking,
that's
right?
Absurd.
Especially like coming from a conversation about 10,000 years timescale. And then it's like, oh, but 20 years ago, that's already gone.
Yeah.
Holy
and just, and just 2 or 3 years later. And this is just, it's a really fundamental problem of the current internet architecture, right?
Yeah, this is entirely yielded by how the internet works today. And it's just a huge shame that we kind of got ourselves into this position, because I think like we could have built a much sounder persistent storage for all this information. I think and in reality it's like not very expensive to do things better. It's just a different approach that yields a different architecture. And it's kind of hard to, the expensive part is to kind of unwind how things are done today and like try to do them a different way. I've seen a lot of those kinds of graphs where, like 10, 20 years ago only 10 or 20% of the material is there. Not just the papers too, like the data is often much at a much higher risk, because at least the paper, there's a strong, it's kind of smaller material. There's strong emphasis on keeping around the publications. They get copied a lot and so on.
Yeah.
So the data often goes completely missing, or large parts of it go completely missing. And so the greatest contribution in some work is really the data, more than the analysis, because the analysis might change dramatically once some new knowledge is discovered.
Exactly.
And so while that the reasoning and the analysis is really important in its time period, the data has a much higher longevity, because the data could be reused in many different kinds of ways many decades later. And that is the portion of information that is at highest risk. And so I was just kind of thinking about this problem in like 2012, 2013. I started thinking a lot about how you could use the version control structures of Git or similar type of systems to then apply that to all scientific knowledge, to the papers, the data, the conversations about the science. Think of like even small micro publications in a sense, or just insights, and being able to track and create a graph and a network of all of this information. And that's what led me to IPFS. I was thinking about it in terms of a kind of scope domain around machine learning, where not only do you need to preserve the information, you also need to move around really large data sets to be able to train models and so on. And there's a kind of a significant problem around gathering, labeling, refining, using and preserving these really large data sets. And yeah, that's kind of how I came to make IPFS. And so it sort of combines the version control sense of Git to be able to address all information with a cryptographic hash, which is a fingerprint of the information. So it gives you an address that, any piece of information, whether it's a single word or a single sentence or whatever, all the way up to, a massive archive of data, you can generate a cryptographic identifier that uniquely identifies that specific piece of data and no other piece of data. And this sort of falls out of cryptography, falls out of how cryptographic hash functions work and so on. But it basically lets you generate a fingerprint that anyone can generate. You don't have to go to a centralized server somewhere. Like, you don't have to go and get a DOI number from, like, you don't have to go and take a ticket at a counter. Because if you build a system like that, then you have to worry about, does the ticket counter still exist? Can you, like, resolve the number in the future? Yeah. With a cryptographic identifier, you're just using math. You're letting math exactly tell you the fingerprint of the data. And then once you have that primitive, you then just need to create a system that allows you to store and retrieve information using those fingerprints. And so the entire IPFS project is about enabling arbitrary web content, all of this kind of information to be addressed and moved around that way.
Right. So just for clarity, this cryptographic fingerprint, basically that's the, it's a better version of a link. Is that a good way to put it?
Just exactly.
Just a URL that you're used to, like facebook.com, whatever. Now this is a cryptographic hash. So it's like a long number and looks messy.
Exactly. So it lets you have a persistent link and a persistent identifier, where you do not rely on a resolver somewhere else or any kind of dynamic mutable link. So you can really create snapshots to content. Now, by creating a persistent snapshot, you lose something, which is the ability to have dynamic structure. So then you have to kind of bring back the dynamic structure a separate way. I've thought about this in terms of how can you create references, like when you think about citing something in a paper or in a database or something like that, how can you create a reference that simultaneously gives you a snapshot and a link that's mutable so that you can have a dynamic structure. And I think the simplest way to do it is to include the dynamic reference in the static snapshot. So meaning you create a persistent identifier that's the same forever, but that specific static reference can point to a piece of information that includes the dynamic link that you can go and refresh and so on. The tricky part of this is just making all the tooling work with that and make browsers work with that and so on. And getting people used to seeing cryptographic hashes and links, which is, yeah, like you mentioned, kind of really annoying. It's like this long number and so on, as opposed to kind of like the nice and smooth short names and so on. But I think thankfully, like, tooling can help a lot with that by being able to kind of intelligently rewriting things and so on.
Hey, hope you're enjoying this episode so far. You can watch all previous Future of Science seminars on our DeSci Foundation YouTube channel or sign up to future seminars at DeSciFoundation.org/seminars. If you'd like to support the DeSci Foundation, you can best do that by subscribing to this podcast, sharing it with friends, or making a donation at DeSciFoundation.org/donate. All links in the description.
So, once you have all of these static snapshots and these versions, you can the link rot problem goes away because you can all of the information that's interlinked with other information preserves a direct static snapshot of the rest of the stuff, right? So you can think of it, and this applies transitively. So if you have a particular paper, that paper should have links and references to the data of the paper and all of its references, right? So that paper would link to other papers and would link to its own data. And then those other papers would link to their data and so on. So you can kind of create this over time, this graph of content where it's all snapshots and persistent snapshots that are never going to change.
Exactly.
Now, of course, if you want to see the latest version of something, you should be able to do that, but that should be kind of an option. Where today that's a requirement. You're only linked to the latest thing. All you have to do is browse around the web a little bit, look at some papers, look at the references, and realize how intractable it is to try and get the original stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the really cool things about this content addressing is that you can literally verify that the link or the address that you were accessing is giving you the content that you wanted, right? So you basically just, you take the content, you rerun that cryptographic hash function on it, and you see if it actually matches the one that you entered.
And like, this is perfect because it actually solves both of these problems, right? Link rot on content drift, both of them are gone. And both of them are such fundamental issues for preserving knowledge, right? So like Eric Schultes, he gave a seminar with us a while ago, and we talked about FAIR data. So this idea of like findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable data, and you know, all the concepts that they came up how we can get there. And one of the most fundamental issues there is that you need persistent identifiers, right?
Yes.
If you do not have a persistent identifier, there is no way on earth that you can actually make scientific data or research objects FAIR. It is just technologically infeasible.
Yes.
And the really interesting thing is that all the people that, like the vast majority of people that are thinking about it and that are actually engaged in making data FAIR, they think of the DOI system as the solution, but the DOI system is really not a solution.
No, not at all. It just creates this big database that you now have to maintain.
Exactly.
And that it itself could get corrupted over time.
Exactly. And it does, right?
Yes.
And it does. Right. So there's also studies on
that. Or you have to worry about the politics of the specific database and what's okay in the current region that the database is hosted. Like all of that is fine while you have, jurisdictions that preserve freedom of speech, but historically you don't have to go very far to find all kinds of censorship and problems in any jurisdiction that you can think of, right? And so you really don't want the scientific literature, which is supposed to give us the our best attempt at finding truth in the universe, to then be kind of subject to whatever is politically okay in a particular moment in time, in a particular region of the world.
This is an interesting idea because this is something that Philip and I spoke about briefly just before this call. Because so essentially now with these persistent identifiers, all the content you publish is tamper-proof, right? You just publish it and it's done. That's it. Nobody can come in after the fact and change your wording. So one thing we talked about of like a piece of information that's been preserved for a pretty long time, considering that all the links from 20 years ago are already broken, is the Bible. It's pretty old, right? Do we actually know that this is still in the right format? Has this been tampered with?
No, but it isn't. Like, there are many different versions, there are many different translations, different interpretations, different like book sets, like depending on what religious branch you're talking about, they have a different notion of what the Bible is.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And for something so fundamental that like shapes societies and like whole states, like the Roman Empire, like at some point was like all about Christianity, and then just the ability to be able to rewrite that book in however format you would like it and to say whatever supports your agenda. That's just so huge. And if you could do that through the scientific record, that's even crazier, because now it's like, oh no, this is truth. This is knowledge. This is facts. But I can make them up.
Yeah. And this has happened many times in many places, right? So whether you're thinking about like the US or the Soviet Union and other places, like there were many points in time where scientific articles were censored or changed or adjusted to fit the right political norms of the time in the right context. Yeah, and then you also have to worry about, even if something gets published correctly at the time, you have to worry about it being changed later. There's been many cases where groups go back and adjust the past. You can see this also in newspapers, where newspapers change their headlines and change their articles quite a bit. And you should be able to see the entire version history of that. Because the fact that you're reporting on something is a statement in and of itself and is changing the world in some way. And you need to be able to see that record.
Exactly. And even something really simple, such as figuring out who wrote something when, this is just such an incredibly important concept, right? So in the context of the Bible, if we would actually know who has written these things and when and who has edited them and how and when, like how many conflicts on this planet could have been prevented if we would have just have like absolutely clear answers to these questions, right?
And same goes for like all kinds of civic, like government-oriented artifacts as well. And
And to come back to this DOI thing, I mean, one of the issues with the DOI system is, of course, that it's actually permission by an entity, right? So it's not that easy to get a DUI, right? So there's this entire bureaucracy, there's a procedure, you have to pay and so on and so forth. And just getting a DUI is actually an issue. Whereas when you use content address storage, basically like this is permissionless, right? So this, it's just running this mathematical
function. It's just math.
There it is. It's exactly.
You're letting the universe itself, physics, give you a number.
Yep. And it's very easily implemented with open source software that anybody can run on their computer. It's just like, you know, it's a very powerful concept.
Yeah, just mentioning the universe, I want to dive into another piece that I find very interesting about IPFS, which is this data storage framework that you've built. So IPFS stands for Interplanetary File System. What? Tell me about the interplanetary part. I am so curious.
Yeah. So that came from how I got to reasoning about the system. So think of like an example where when you click a link, like, you know, instagram.com/mypicture.jpg or something like that. What your browser is actually doing is at first it's resolving what instagram.com is. It has to like ask a bunch of computers in the network what instagram.com is today, because that could be a different location in the future or in the past. Then it gets a specific IP address and a number, and then it dials and connects to that IP address. And then it says, hey, could you please, I'm looking for instagram.com/mypicture.jpg. Can you please give it to me? And you have to take whatever that server gives you as the truth, because the entire link is based on that resolution at that moment in time. Now, imagine that that server is not somewhere else on Earth that has like nice sub-second latencies, but is on Mars. Mm-hmm. So now you have to wait, 4 to 8 minutes, depending on the time of year, for your message to get all the way over there, and then 4 to 8 minutes to come all the way back. Uh-huh. So this is clearly insane, right? Like, like you would not build the web that way if the latencies were bigger. Like, if you had to interconnect servers that way, where you had to like go all the way over there. Now, that difference is kind of like a human perception level difference. And so, from my perspective, it's like, okay, great. Like, let's build the internet and infrastructure such that it works across planets, and you make that work really well so that you don't do these crazy resolution times all the way across the from planet to planet, and you end up with a structure where if the content is already on Earth, you should be able to just find it wherever it is on Earth and get it from there. You don't want to wait all, you know, the 4 to 8 seconds to go somewhere else. So it turns out that exact same notion that I sort of call the interplanetary principle when designing distributed systems applies to normal latencies within Earth as well. Like, when you don't think about human resolution times and you think of computers, there's a huge difference in, say, a microsecond and a millisecond in a resolution, or say even a millisecond and a second. And so something that might be not that perceptible for humans is tremendously important to computers. Like, you're talking about thousands of times of difference. And so if you build things with this kind of interplanetary principle in mind, then how you retrieve content through very slow networks or in programs that are supposed to work at super high speeds looks the same. So going from one data center to another data center on Earth is kind of like going from Earth to Mars, but for programs. And so the point there is like, we should be building the internet and the infrastructure with that in mind and designing information to be retrieved from wherever closest to where it's needed, not to, you know, some other location really far away. Where like really far away for humans might be other planets, and for computers it might be other data centers. Yeah, so that's kind of like where that comes from.
It's more of a metaphor, and you're not trying to get us to the interplanetary species.
No, we are. So it is. It is both a principle that you can use to apply locally, but it does give you the architecture that you need to make it work in an interplanetary scale. We have full intention to make the internet work interplanetary in an interplanetary way. In fact, today we're already working on some tests with putting the resolving content between Earth and the moon. So like there's a mission that's going to bring IPFS all the way to the moon. IPFS already running in the ISS. Get it to the moon and then later on Mars.
That is amazing.
we want to build like an application stack that you can just run, you know, for the first settlers in Mars that go and spend some time there. They should be able to have an internet stack that just works out of the box. And so we're building
amazing.
That.
Oh my God, I love that.
That is super cool. So how far is that away in your perception? Like, when are we going to have the first settlers on Mars?
It's a good question. So when I first started IPFS, I was kind of using the SpaceX timelines, so and they were kind of like saying 2026, 2028. I think Starship might get us there in time, might get a few groups in time, but it probably, I would think, is more like 2030, 32 or 34, like that time period might be more likely for the first kind of first missions. That's kind of like the best optimistic guess. So I would say, you know, kind of best optimistic guess would be 26, 28. Second would be like, you know, the early 30s. Most likely it would be like late 30s and 40s. But
yeah, it's like don't trust Elon Musk when he says a year, because like he's delayed the release of fully autonomous driving for Tesla for like 9 years in a row. It's like next year.
It's a surprising. It's an Elon timeline. It's a surprisingly hard problem that is like super deceptive. The other thing there is like, and this has to do with R&D and how you kind of orient groups of people to do R&D in a really fast time scale. You have to set tremendously ambitious deadlines and goals and like fully commit to those like 100%. And many times you won't make it and many times you will. And so this is I think the Elon timeline is more of an artifact out of how R&D processes work. Mm-hmm. It's just that a lot of organizations don't publish those. And so they're like either won't publish a deadline to the world. I think about Apple, right? So Apple also sets tremendously ambitious timelines, but they don't tell the world. Uh-huh. Sometimes.
Right. Exactly.
although the iPhone is a very good example. Like they set out to build it. They didn't have anything. And it took them like 2 years to build the first version. And then on stage, Steve announced like, oh yeah, we're going to be shipping these in like 9 months. And the team in charge of shipping it is like, what?
Yeah.
And, like they had nothing on how to manufacture it and ship it and so on. And they had to figure out all of that in on the fly. So it's kind of like, unfortunately, how human R&D processes work. We sort of require these hard deadlines that force the all of the work to kind of compress and happen on time. And if you don't have a good deadline, then groups of people don't tend to kind of like overrun the time and kind of stretch it out and so on.
Yeah.
So, totally. So going back to like the Mars question, like, yeah, it's unclear. I would say, I think it's a good guess to think like late 20s, early 30s, in that that's possible. But I think it sort of depends on whether or not we focus really hard on that. And I think like it requires a lot of people aiming for that specific goal. And I don't know how focused SpaceX is on that goal at the moment. They might be. I think there was a lot of work on Starship, and I think that's getting a lot closer. It's kind of like slowed down a bit. But I think if they, you know, keep up the rate, we could make it.
So talking about timeline, when do you think IPFS and Filecoin are going to replace Amazon and the Web2 infrastructure? Or is that not going to happen?
We're intending for that to happen. I think it kind of like good, what's likely to work. So technology companies tend to become kind of sedimentary layers. Like think about like IBM mainframes from the mm-hmm. 70s and 80s. Like they're still mm-hmm. around and mm-hmm. people still use them. Yeah. And if anything, they've kind of like adapted and got recast in terms of the public cloud, like AWS and so on. So I think a good outcome here would be that all of the Amazon-style clouds in the world like just start adopting things like IPFS and start referencing all of their content with this kind of content. And then separately, that Filecoin, we aim for it to be one of the main source networks on the planet, and we want to get to somewhere between 50 and 80% of the content on the network. Although I really think it is very good to have, it's kind of like what we should aim for, but in reality, the world should have many different storage networks. Like I think human systems tend to work much better when you have like diversity of system and you don't have any kind of central point of failure. But I think, even getting to something like 10 to 20% of the content on the world is massive. Even Amazon is kind of like hovering around that scale or less. Because there are like many different cloud systems.
Yeah. So for listeners, can you explain what is a Filecoin and what's the difference to IPFS?
Yeah. So Filecoin came from thinking about how to use cryptographic currencies to be able to incentivize the content distribution. And so this kind of when I was first making IPFS, I was thinking about how to incentivize the distribution of content using Bitcoin because Bitcoin had just sort of, it started in 2008, 2009, but it was just kind of picking up steam in 2011, 2012, 13. And I'd been kind of a student of a lot of the, you know, many distributed systems in the past, many different kind of file systems, especially research file systems like AFS from Carnegie Mellon, and of course the web, and NFS, which is kind of like a large system that's deployed in a lot of places, plus also the peer-to-peer network. So like things like Skype and things like BitTorrent and so on that have been tremendously successful at creating these kind of resource sharing structures, or say like SETI at home and so on, which were like really good early experiments of how you could create these kind of like large scale resource sharing networks and kind of public clouds in a sense. And where public cloud doesn't mean there's a company offering a public service, but rather the cloud itself is made out of the public coming together and bringing our machines and resources together to form these networks. And what didn't work in a lot of them was that there was a huge resource disparity between the people that would provide the resources and the people that would consume the resources. So as an example here would be like in BitTorrent, a lot of people would maybe seed content and the vast majority would never reseed again. They would just kind of download and not reseed. So they wouldn't, you have this kind of like free rider problem. Skype kind of solved it by using corporate networks. So Skype realized that like the best Skype nodes were nodes that were within corporate networks, and they would like immediately promote those nodes to be super nodes, and they would relay most of the traffic. So like your Skype node at home probably wouldn't be doing much. And so you ended up with this like resource contribution disparity where like groups in specific locations ended up providing most of the work to build the network. And that always struck me as kind of unfair, because if you're sort of like bringing and contributing more to the system, one thing that you can do is kind of just create a market and create a reward structure and a reward mechanism to make that be both more fair and more equitable, but also to cause really high performance systems to emerge, right? So though things like BitTorrent and Skype were successful, we hadn't seen things of that scale apply to a problem as hard as do super high performance storage, like, you know, at the cloud levels of quality, or super high performance compute and so on. And so if you really want to solve problems very efficiently and provide extremely high quality of service, you have to, at the end of the day, be able to pay people and businesses to kind of solve that. And so that's where kind of incentivizing the distribution of content with cryptocurrency came from. And as I kind of poked around on the problem more, it became clear that you could actually use the incentive structure of Bitcoin itself, like the kind of proof of work mechanism. And instead of just kind of doing this wasteful proof of work, Bitcoin has this kind of process where it just sort of causes this wasteful puzzle to organize the machines. You could actually do something really useful with that problem and cause the storage of files in the network to become that contribution of work. And so you sort of create a reward mechanism that rewards the network for storing more and more and more data for the network, and or more and more capacity to store data. And so that's kind of where Filecoin came from. And so we're building this large-scale network that is, you know, cryptocurrency incentivized to enable anybody to contribute their resources and their storage to maintain content for the network. And ideally, like the information architecture that humanity is built on shouldn't depend on the sort of like local temporary whims of specific geopolitical conflicts. And today it does. Like today the internet and the cloud are totally dependent on the local proclivities of different groups. Like internets get shut down. Like local internet gets shut down in different places. Different things get censored. Important information doesn't get across to different groups. And so we really need to get to a point where the most fundamental and important things that humans do, which is kind of communicate with each other and share our knowledge, share our information, should be kind of as freely guaranteed worldwide as we possibly can. And so that's kind of what attracts me to Web3 and things like that, because it's kind of about baking in these important rights across the world.
Exactly. So I actually wanted to ask you something just for my personal curiosity and understanding. So currently the Filecoin system is, of course, primarily incentivizing this the cold storage of data, right? Which raises the question, why? Why is that? So why that decision? Because like...
First, what is cold storage?
What is cold storage? What is hot storage? And why that, right?
So cold and hot means the time it takes you to retrieve the content. So in kind of like normal internet latencies, like hot would be, you know, 100 milliseconds or less, so that it's like not human perceptible when you get something. And cold traditionally would be like many seconds to minutes, or like kind of in Amazon's Glacier's time, it would be potentially many hours until you get the content. Because it's just dramatically cheaper when you do that. You can use certain kinds of storage media like tape and other kinds of systems that are just way slower to move around and access. In Filecoin's case, this didn't come as a decision. It came as something that fell out of the cryptography. So in order to make things work, we used a thing called a proof of replication. And the one that we sort of started with and we got to ended up like way slower than than would give you hot storage. Mm. So that's kind of like where it started. But Filecoin already does hot storage. So even though like it might be some of the information is kind of like a little bit outdated in that we now are building a CDN on top of Filecoin to give you really fast sub-second retrieval. So Filecoin is already incentivizing both cold and hot storage. It's just that we started with cold, but that kind of fell out of the cryptography.
So how does the incentivization of the hot storage then work?
Great question. So we don't use a proof of replication there. There are two models for incentivizing hot storage distribution. One is where sort of like clients pay for the constant retrievals, and like that becomes pretty like just straightforward and easy to solve. Except that most people in the world don't want to pay for retrievals of content. Mm-hmm. So
exactly, then we have a paywall again, right? So
yeah. Well, yeah. Well, or you could like bake it into the browsers, right? So you could use browsers like Brave and so on that have some kind of cryptocurrency built into them to like automatically pay for things. So it wouldn't necessarily feel like a paywall, but it would. But it definitely, there's a hurdle there. So most people in the world don't want to pay for content. Instead, the content publisher has to pay for the content distribution.
Yeah.
So in the content publisher pays model, you end up having to figure out this problem between the person that's requesting the content, the person that's serving the content, and the content publisher. And between these three parties, you end up having to solve the problem through kind of fraud detection in a sense, or reputation systems, where you have to like log the when the requests are happening, and then try to reason about what actually happened and so on. It's not as nice and straightforward as the normal the retriever pays model, because that's like much easier to solve. Technically, this other model is a little bit harder. So it's kind of building a kind of reputation oriented system, and then rewarding parties for serving really high, really good retrievals at really low latencies and so on. That part of Filecoin is called Filecoin Saturn.
And how far along is that?
So it's where I have about 1,000 or something POPs, points of presence. And so these are like different groups that are maintaining different nodes. And people can already start using it. It's kind of on a alpha/beta preview period. And we're already moving a bunch of our traffic through the IPFS gateway over to be served by Saturn nodes.
That's super cool. That seems really like it's like a growth process, right? So it's like you have this little baby, and it just keeps growing, and it keeps adding capabilities, and and learns new things. And first it's like so we solved the content address, the content drift and the link rot problem, and we can store cold data. Now we can store hot data. And the next thing is obviously going to be like, how do we actually do compute, right? So that's the next big thing.
Yes. Yeah. That's a whole other like really, really awesome part, which is like, great. So you're storing the data. It would be great to be able to do computations over it and be able to start running like your data analysis through it. And imagine being able to run like your Jupyter notebook type things directly on a cloud like this. That and one of the really cool things about these kinds of systems is they let you give a huge cost reduction. So today, storing things on Filecoin and later on being able to compute on them, it's going to be way, way cheaper than doing it through like the normal cloud, more than 10x cheaper.
So why is that? What is the magic sauce here?
Yeah, good question. So I think there's a couple of different parts. So one is that by having a free market, you enable any participant that sees an available cost reduction to try and use it and take it. And so you end up with cost reductions that are just not possible for large centralized entities, or that they might just not make sense for them to take. So you end up with the system that can optimize better, kind of in the longer time scales. Another effect here is that sometimes people are contributing resources that they have already bought or spent for other use cases. So you're kind of like amortizing the cost with some other use. So that means like they're really looking at sort of spare capacity that they wouldn't otherwise be making any money for. So they're able to offer that at a much lower and more reduced cost. And then in other cases, it just sort of drops out of the kind of like long-term cryptocurrency network sort of effect, which is kind of the future success subsidizes the past a bit, where, and this kind of happened with Bitcoin and Ethereum and so on as well, where part of the what the block reward incentive sort of sets up is this structure where people might be providing the service at sort of like exact cost, but they're sort of realizing their successes sometime in the future. And so then that, if the network isn't growing over time and so on, then you're able to kind of reward the giver in the past with some slice of the returns of the future.
Okay, interesting.
That's really cool. So then we ultimately end up with a system that is just literally made for science, right? So it's like the problem of linkwad and content drift is gone. You actually have the capability to store massive amounts of data at competitive prices. We will be able to actually run compute jobs on that. We will be able to authenticate who has done what when.
Yes.
This is basically, these are the building blocks that we need to actually move science really into the digital age.
And it's been really awesome to see that some of the first adopters of Filecoin are large universities and large institutions that have these massive scale data sets. So like there's a neutrino experiment in Berkeley, and then there's the Atlas experiment in CERN, and these are like some of the early adopters of Filecoin with like massive scale data sets. You're talking about like tens to hundreds of petabytes at a time, and then being able to both store and archive that information for the future, and then later on being able to process process it itself. So yeah, I think it's sort of like early days. Like we're the Filecoin network first went live in 2020. So IPFS is much older. Like IPFS started in 2015 was when we launched the alpha, and now. Yeah, Filecoin started in 2020. And yeah, it's been a short period of time and already the network is, around 15 exabytes of capacity, which is an enormous, enormous cloud. So it really kind of like has tremendously cheap storage for all of these kind of archival of really vital information. Plus later on, we'll add the computing capabilities to be able to do your, like, I really want to get to a point where like you have everything you need to run all of your experiments and your data analysis pipeline entirely on this kind of model where it's like sort of freely accessible to anybody. All you need is to pay cryptocurrency. You don't have to have a credit card or be in standing in a specific government or something like that. Like all you need is some freely tradable resource on the internet, and then you should be able to kind of do your science. I've been reading a lot of kind of the history of like scientists leading up to World War II, like the period in kind of physics of doing all the particle physics experiments to figure out both all the kind of like the discovery of like the nuclear forces, plus the splitting of the atom and so on, and kind of all of the how all of the experiments were happening and how they had to get like certain kinds of approvals and resources to be able to run those experiments at a time in a period where like the nature of the work was just so geopolitically impactful, right? Like you had scientists who were doing all of this work, or who originally were in different parts of Germany or different parts of in Denmark and other places, and then had to like emigrate some either like right leading up to the war, or who didn't, but who were keenly aware of the implications. So, like famously, Leo Szilard was thinking about the chain reactions of the nucleus and potentially getting to fission and so on for many years ahead of the war, and many scientists were kind of like in this kind of ambivalent structure where they needed to be able to know whether or not this was possible to do, because if some group got it ahead of another group, it could be like catastrophic, and just kind of the access to the facilities to be able to do the work, the access to the information. The information was it was hard for the information to flow. There was a moment in time where like some of the work wasn't getting directly published in specific locations, or it was getting published but not paid attention to. And so you got like all of these kind of political problems interlaced on top of the science of actually figuring out how the physics of the nucleus worked. And it was just so tremendously important for the world that could happen in a kind of like future aligned oriented way. And that history could have gone a very different way. It kind of like was on kind of a knife edge there. And so thankfully, like things have turned out better than they otherwise could have. But it's extremely tricky when you think about like other kinds of R&D and so on, and what might be kind of co-opted or restricted or oriented in one way or used in a particular structures. So I really want to get to an environment where the scientific community can do the work together and share the resources and knowledge freely, and try to arrive at a globally aligned view of like how to use the information. And this kind of nuance, right? Because there are certain things where you have to be really careful and potentially do create kind of like restrictions on publication. Like there was a huge controversy around being able to publish like genetic sequences of certain viruses. And that's something that like I think is probably something that we should censor. But you have to be like very kind of targeted and specific about what and why and so on, and realize that like most of the time censorship ends up benefiting a particular state at the downside of other states and at the downside for most of humanity and most of scientific progress. And so it's definitely like a tricky environment, but it's sort of like at the end of the day, I want to get to kind of building this scientific platform where you can kind of interconnect all of the research that you're doing in kind of like this broader global commons, and kind of the work that you're doing, the data that you're generating, and the analysis that you're doing kind of becomes, you know, kind of discovering new leaves in the tree of knowledge, and you're interconnecting all of it together as you're doing it. And you don't have to kind of like pass all of this through kind of necessarily going through specific services, specific journals or providers or whatever before it can be interconnected and interlinked. One of the best things here, I think, has been the preprint servers gaining so wide adoption has been tremendously successful. Many branches of science are now publishing directly to preprint servers like Archive.
Yep.
And then later, potentially sometimes,
yep,
highlighting things in journals or conferences. And I think that's very much closer to what science how science should work. It's just that ideally, all of the research artifacts associated with the work should be published the same way. So like all of the data, all of the analysis, it should all be like runnable. Like you should be able to look at any paper and immediately jump to like where's the data and what are the programs that were used to like generate the figures and do the analysis,
exactly,
and so on.
Exactly.
And then be able to like immediately, you know, click one button and you are in a notebook again yourself, and you can like run your own experiments or your own questions and so on and contribute those as well, right? So like that's kind of the vision of where we want to go.
It's funny you say that. There's a product out there. It's called DeepSide Notes. It
exactly.
Sounds like it kind of does that. I heard about it.
Yes.
But no, this is awesome. And I love the vision that you just painted of this democratizing access to data, to compute, and to science, and actually allowing anybody who has a computer and has an internet connection, which we're not far from everybody having that, or not too far, we're definitely not there yet, but everyone basically being able to contribute to this knowledge creation process and to be able to participate and actually follow the creation of knowledge. I think that's a beautiful vision. And I definitely hope we get there. And I'm very grateful for you working towards that mission too. I think we're close to running out of time. So it's probably wise for us to transition to the lightning round, which is it's just going to be five quick questions. You'll be able to answer with one word or one sentence max.
So let's see.
That's gonna be a challenge.
Exactly.
It is. It's funny because like we get a lot of brainy people on this podcast, and this is the hardest part.
So yes.
It's actually being able to answer a question that in just one word or one sentence. Here's your first question: will you try to live on Mars?
Yes.
It's gonna be awfully cold up there.
Yeah, you know, I'm currently in Iceland, and Iceland is tremendously beautiful, and it is very cold here as well, and I've been getting used to it, so.
Cool. All right, next one. What was your favorite song as a teenager?
Oh, wow. That is a very hard one.
So you ask about like preserving knowledge for millions of years,
yes,
and there's
exactly.
like a paragraph coming out of you.
What I was listening to. Like, I'm personally embarrassed about the stuff that I was listening to when I was 13, 14. Like seriously. Like,
yeah.
What did you listen to, Philip?
Oh my God. I mean, this was the 80s, Carla. Like this was like, you know, there's the coolest thing that we had around in the time was like, was punk, but it was also like a lot of like pop and Madonna and Michael Jackson and Aha and like a lot of schmaltz. So
Yeah. This is a great question. I don't even know. Like, I listened to it. Yeah. A bunch of different kinds of stuff. Yeah. A lot of like pop and rock and also a lot of like stuff from the 60s and 70s.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Interesting. All right. Vague answer, but we'll let it count. Next question. Yes or no? Will aliens use IPFS?
It's highest likelihood that they don't.
Okay. I agree. Yes. So, yeah.
But mostly because it's the highest likelihood that there aren't, at least the information that we have so far is that there aren't aliens within the galaxy. And so maybe we say an alien intelligence might be artificial intelligence, then yes.
So
if we're thinking about other biological aliens, yes, if we count artificial intelligences.
Okay. Got it.
Beautiful. How many hours of sleep do you need?
Oh, very 7-ish.
Yeah.
So I have gotten a lot less sleep over the many years, but mm-hmm. as I've gotten older, it's become more and more important that I sleep a good amount. The thing that I think is very important here is people should that sleep less than 7 hours should really read the research on sleep and memory loss in older uh-huh. age. It's uh-huh. alarming. There's this super high correlation between not getting enough sleep and just all kinds of neurodegenerative diseases and memory loss yeah. and so on. So yeah. that was like influential in me getting a lot more sleep.
Exactly.
But even 7 is kind of low.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's a great excuse, using the research to be able to finally sleep in.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that I remember from working with psychiatrists and in research. So apparently for a lot of mental disorders, actually an indicator is, so especially for depression, an indicator is actually sleeping either way too little or way too much. And both of it is problematic for your mental health. Any case.
Yep.
Anyway, so I think the hardest question comes from Carla, the last one.
Yeah, so we asked this question and it completely knocked James Boyd from Wolfram Institute out. So let's see if you're up to the challenge. What's your spirit animal?
Polar bear.
Oh,
absolutely.
Wow.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yes. That was a great
yeah. I've been a polar bear forever. this is a big thing in our... yeah, in my group of friends and so on. We spirit animals.
That's
and so
really
on.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, you passed the vibe check. Thank you so much, Juan. It's been great having you on. It was a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Really, thanks for having me. This was really, really fun.
Thanks, Juan.
Thanks for tuning into the Future of Science podcast. We have exciting news. The DeSci Foundation has now started accepting donations to support MetaScience. Head to dscifoundation.org/donate to join the cause. Oh, also feel free to subscribe, rate, review, sign up for a live seminar, and all that other good stuff. All important links in the description. See you next time.